Welcome to the Humanist Union of Madison monthly meeting. Our speaker today is Andy Summers. Andy.
That's about the best introduction I've ever had.
Short.
Short and sweet. Bob asked me to talk a little bit about the changes that have taken place in Ireland. And of course, as I mentioned before, I'm really not a historian. My experience there has been anecdotal. I've been to Ireland on many occasions and met the Irish people, and I've seen and talked about things. And I became to appreciate a lot of things. One, I was raised with a lot of myths, and there's a lot of myths about Ireland, a lot of phony myths. One of which is, I remember St. Patrick chased the snakes out of Ireland and brought Christianity. Well, he brought Christianity, but there were no snakes in Ireland because of the Ice Age, I guess. There's one lizard there now, but they don't have any snakes. But it wasn't St. Patrick. And St. Patrick wasn't Irish. He was English. He was an English slave. One of the things he did when he got to Ireland is kind of destroy the poor religion they had. It was the Druids. And they had a pretty good religion. It was a pretty natural religion. They had laws, the Irish had laws, the Brehon laws, which were very, very fair. Women had equal rights. There were no prisons. They didn't believe in prisons. Our friends, the English, came in and taught them about prisons. But the Irish had a system where if you did something wrong, you paid a fine. And you paid the fine to the family that you're wrong. But they learned how to have prisons when our friends, the English, came in. The English came in, of course, and took over the country and have been there for 800 years. They came in to help Henry. I think Henry II was known as the Landless King or something like that. Somewhere around that, we had a pope, the first English and the only English pope. His name is Adrian. And he somehow gave Ireland to Henry. I don't know how you give a country to it. But I don't know what popes and kings were back then, but apparently they were the big behind the scenes smoke room guys, you know. So that was the beginning of troubles for Ireland. Ireland was always a friendly little country. It was a very good, wealthy, as far as agriculture, they had the best fertile land in Europe. The English came in and they wanted to change everything. It was part of the conquest. They wanted to change the language. They came up with some beautiful things called the penal laws. And it became a crime to speak Irish. It became a crime to dance. It became a crime after a while to be a Catholic. They had a whole bunch of crimes because they wanted to suppress the language and they wanted to suppress the culture. A couple of little anecdotes I'll throw out to you, trivia that you really aren't asking for, but I'll give you anyway. People might wonder why the Irish kids who dance only dance from the legs down. They don't move their arms. Well, it was outlawed to dance, believe it or not. The English outlawed that as part of the culture. And so if a constable walked by a house, they would see these kids standing there, not moving, but their legs were moving. Anyway, that's a little trivia. You could put it somewhere, maybe.
Is that true, Andy? Yeah.
Well, I wasn't there.
Oh, no.
I was not there. But if you Google it, you find that's one of the things. The other thing they thought that the Catholic Church might have been against it because they didn't want couples, men and boy and girls, to touch. So they had to anyway. It ended up with a very strange dance, which is very beloved today. There are other myths that we were always taught. I was taught as a kid that, and I got this through the American press. I got it through just conversations with people. And I believe them. One is that the Irish fought with everybody. They loved to fight. Well, I found out later they didn't fight with anybody except the English. There was no fight between anybody over there. The other myth was that everything over there was Protestant against Catholic. It was just a bunch of war between religions. That was so that people would ignore that it was a war against the English, and they would think that it was a religious war. If you look at the history of Ireland, some of the greatest leaders they had were Protestants. One of their big, the French leader was Wolfe Tone, who was a Protestant. One of their writers, Sean O'Casey, George Bernard Shaw, Yeats. These are all Protestants. Jonathan Swift. They were Protestant and they were all nationalists. By nationalists, I meant they wanted Ireland to have their own identity. So there was no battle in the beginning between Catholic and Protestant. Later, the English fostered that because what they did was they ended up putting all their people up north and they brought them in from Scotland and they were called planters. They kicked the Irish off their land and brought these planters in, gave them land. These would be loyal to the crown. It was the theory of divide and conquer. And those are the people that resisted Irish people in the north. And that's where some of the worst battles came from people we call the loyalists, who were those loyal to the crown. And so it's not a religious thing. Half the people over there don't go to church. And they wouldn't know it's not they're not fighting over the Our Father, they're not fighting over the Apostles' Creed. They're fighting on where you were born and what your loyalty was. That was what the fight in the north became. The other thing is the Irish were torn, or they were pressured between two groups, the English and the Catholic Church. And the Irish do not like authority. That's one thing. And they embraced the church, and they allowed the church because they thought that was their protection. But they found that for the most part, the Catholic Church did not protect them. The Catholic Church made peace with the English. The Catholic schools were all financed through the English. So the church found it a lot easier to side with the English and tell people not to rebel, to be orderly, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and be a nice citizen. A lot of the Irish didn't like that. But they kept at it because the church was all they had on their side. Came the famine, it was that was when a lot of the Irish came to America. It was interesting that it wasn't the church here or anywhere that first gave food to the Irish. The first people who gave food to the Irish during the famine were the Quakers. And they also have some stories about the American Indians sending money over. But it was not an American Catholic item until it got really bad. There was no news coming over about what was going on in the famine until people started coming over and telling. But it wasn't the church that jumped right in. There was an old anecdote that the Irish would tell that with their loyalty, that no priest ever starved during the famine. They took care, and that's why your joke was apropos about not letting the priest out in the rain. They held a great respect for the priest. A lot of this, and they came up with some very strange laws. I mean, they had the most restrictive laws in Europe, especially on sexual and reproductive rights. They came up with some very severe legislation. One they got from England. England had outlawed homosexuality, and the Irish picked that up. The English didn't like one of the homosexuals they put in prison was Oscar Wilde. Another, they used it to destroy his memory, was a great Irishman who tried to help the Irish cause, and he betrayed the Queen. His name was Roger Casement, and the English, somehow he died in jail. They're not quite, these people somehow just get in jail and die. Nobody quite understands why they die in jail. But they released Casement's diaries, the English, which showed that he was homosexual. And this was enough to destroy his image among the Irish, they thought. The other person they had to worry about, they had some, one of the, I can't remember the great Irish leader that they destroyed because...
Emmett? Robert Emmett?
No, he was the one who was living with Kitty O'Shea. And for years, he was living with her. And the English released this, and of course the Irish were shocked. They were still in that stage where sex was a shocking thing. So for years, you couldn't buy contraceptives in Ireland. The strange thing was, about 40 years ago, they had a contraceptive factory in Ireland. It was a German factory making contraceptives that you couldn't buy. You could only ship them out. I mean, that's how strange things were. Abortion is still a struggle in Ireland. They still have not come to terms. They had a scandal just 2 years ago about an Indian lady who went to a hospital and her fetus was infected and they wouldn't take it out. They were using the old Catholic idea that if it came the choice between the fetus and the mother goes. I heard that when I was a kid and it didn't bother me too much because I was a guy. But I wondered what the girls in the class were thinking mm-hmm. when they were told that if they get in one of those situations, a priest I talked to said, that never comes up. Don't worry about it. But that was the teaching here, and it was the teaching in Ireland, that you could not have an abortion to save the mother's life. They've since changed it a little bit. They still do not make allowance for rape or incest.
Like we're moving that way, right?
They're trying. Yeah. Well, you know, the funny thing is that I see so many similarities between this country and our country. When the Irish came over here, they were not wanted. They came over during the famine. They had no jobs. They were poor. They were still speaking a mixture of English and Irish. So they would have a lot of D's and O's and things. They couldn't pronounce certain H's. The WASPs in our country did not like them and condemned them as illiterate, poor, worthless, drunken. There was a cartoonist in New York who was very vicious. His name was Thomas Nast. Mm. And he had terrible cartoons about the Irish. There were signs in shops, Irish need not apply. And I look at some of this and I wonder, have we come anywhere from that? Because now we just change it. And it's not Irish need not apply, it's immigrant or Mexican need not apply. And we're doing the same thing over and over again. It's the WASPs who are attacking the foreigners.
Well, we have to pick on somebody.
Well, the sad thing with the Irish who came over here is they wanted to become Americanized so much. Mm-hmm. They became American in a hurry. They took on all the bad qualities. They became the most bigoted. They became the most vicious. They were never there for the civil rights. They were an enemy of civil rights.
Really?
Boston, Philadelphia, New York, there were riots. I had some Irish people coming from Ireland over on a couple of things, and they would meet, and they turned to me and they'd say, why are these people so bigoted? The Irish from Ireland were not bigoted, and they didn't understand the hatred of black people that the American Irish had.
Don't you understand?
I couldn't explain it.
Sure. It's because any time an immigrant group starts to make it, they're terrified of being classified with the most recently come in, and so they dump on them.
Well, and it's the thing about work. They're taking our work, and although, you know, today when I hear this, I really don't mind a Mexican going out in the field and picking things. I didn't really sign up for that job. I wouldn't be upset that he's taken that job away from me. And if you talk to a lot of white people, they'd have to admit that they weren't going out in any fields and picking corn. Or they weren't going to do that. But anyway, they're taking our jobs. Let's come back. We... part of the myth that was brought about was caused by, nicely caused by some Irish people, and one, John Ford, who was a great director of movies. He had some of the greatest westerns with John Wayne. He had one lovely movie. It was called The Quiet Man. It's all about Ireland. A beautiful, great movie if you want to see a movie about Ireland. The Irish hated it because it made the Irish look like caricatures. It made them so simple and so, you know, loving, kind and stuff, but simple people. And they really didn't like that movie. It was a very popular movie with us. The other ones I saw, if you have a chance to Google this and get it on eBay, it was a great threesome by John Ford. It was called The Rising of the Moon. And one was about a very funny one, about a train coming into the station, and they announced there'll be 1 minute wait, and you can imagine what they do. There's no 1 minute wait. They're putting donkeys on the train, and then they're waiting for some. Anyway, three wonderful stories if you get a chance to watch John Ford's. But he gave us a very simple idea of what Ireland was, and the Irish were never very simple. If you look at some of the people that came out of there, some of the poets, I mean, Yeats was not a simple person. You know, Seamus Heaney was not a simple person. I had to laugh because the English did not like Irish people getting any fame. And I was in Belfast riding around, and I turned the radio on, and I heard some of the English announcers say, "And this afternoon we will hear from that great English poet, Seamus Heaney." And I almost smashed the car up. When did he become English? And when I was a kid, of course, I was taught these great English authors were all, you know, O'Casey and Yeats, and these are George Bernard Shaw. These were English authors. Well, they're not. They're Irish.
They wrote in Oscar Wilde.
Oscar Wilde. But they were Irish people. I'm proud of it. One of the things that changed Ireland is politics. And the politics back in 1916, we had a rising in Dublin. It was ill-fated, they did not succeed. And most of the people who were involved with that were executed. Some of the names we saw back there that weren't executed were Éamon de Valera. He was not executed because at the last minute his mother sent his birth certificate, which showed that he was born in the Bronx. And that's the only thing that saved him. Patrick Pearse was killed, James Connolly. They were all executed by the British because they were in that uprising. And that uprising started with a small group of people, but it inflamed, the executions inflamed the Irish psycho, that they became very strong and vigilant and began a struggle, which ended in 1922, when Ireland separated from England. They got their peace. They got England, but on English terms. The Irish got dominion status. They later declared that they were independent. But the little circle up in the north was kept by the English. What they call Northern Ireland. And if you talk to an Irishman today who's very picky about this, he'll say there's no place called Northern Ireland. If you're talking about the north of Ireland, you can. But Ireland is one country. And 1916 was the first successful in rebellion in that sense. There were so many other rebellions that were put down, mainly because the Irish had no weapons. If you want to read some good history about the Irish, there's a man named Thomas Fleming who wrote The Year of the French. They made a movie out of that. And it was about a rebellion in the 1700s. The reason I accepted this talk is, one, I like to talk about Ireland and I'm a bit of a ham, and it was going to give me a chance to read you a part of a poem by Yeats, which is called Easter 1916. Now, Yeats was not a nationalist, but he was so taken with what happened in 1916 that he wrote this poem. And a lot in the poem, I won't read the whole poem, but a lot of it in there is a bit of autobiographical, where he brings in certain things like his love for a lady who was, she was scorned, and the guy, he refers to the guy who won her love as a drunken, vainglorious guy. Anyway, this was part of his appreciation of what happened in 1916, and that's what the poem's called. He says, I have met them at the close of day, coming with vivid faces from counter or desk among gray 18th century houses. I have passed with a nod of the head or polite, meaningless words. Or have lingered a while and said polite, meaningless words. And thought before I had done of a mocking tale or a jibe to please a companion around the fire at the club, being certain that they and I but lived where motley is worn. All changed, changed utterly. A terrible beauty is born. I call on, too long a sacrifice can make a stone of the heart. Oh, when may it suffice? That is heaven's part, our part, to murmur name upon name, as a mother names her child when sleep at last has come on limbs that had run wild. What is it but nightfall? Oh, no, not night, but death. Was it needless death after all? For England may keep faith for all that is done and said. We know their dream enough to know they dreamed and are dead. But what if excess of love bewildered them till they died? I write it out in a verse. McDonough and McBride and Connolly and Pierce, now and in time to be, wherever green is worn, are changed, changed utterly. A terrible beauty is born. That's such a beautiful poem. Next year is going to be the 100th anniversary of 1960 Rebellion, and Ireland is going to go crazy. It's a good time to go to Ireland. They're going to be celebrating from the beginning of the year to the end. The big time will be Easter, because that's when the rebellion was, Easter Sunday. But that'll be 100 years. And that so changed Ireland, that rebellion. A political party came. The first political party that came was called Sinn Féin. And Sinn Féin later became the leader in the struggle for nationalism. They became totally disliked by the Catholic Church, one of which is because their theme was that Ireland should be united, socialist, and free. And the word socialist came, for some reason, grates the Catholic Church. I don't know why. It's Marxist or something. The Irish had to change that a little bit, soften it, when they came over here to get our help. And we gave help all throughout many years to the Irish cause. But they softened the Marxist part. They didn't let the Americans know too much about that, because the Americans have this terrible idea of what socialism is without knowing that all of Europe is socialistic. But that didn't matter. They try to keep away from that when they talk to American politicians. Mm-hmm. Sinn Féin went on. And one of the things that was used against them was they were the political party, the political wing of some group called the IRA. And the IRA was probably the only group that stood between total oppression and some sort of protection for the Irish people. Again, the Catholic Church got involved. I remember I was up in Ireland at the time when the priest got up in one church and they said to the parishioners, you must not have anything to do with the IRA. They are Marxists, they are communists. Anyone who has anything to do with the IRA will be, what's the word they use?
Excommunicated.
Half the parish got up and left and never came back. That was a little bit of the break with this great Catholic Church, when the people realized that politically the Catholic Church was not always their friend. There's another, the deal that was made between England and the Catholic Church. They built a seminary in Maynooth, and the English paid for it, gave it to the Catholic Church under the stipulation that no word could ever be said against the English, and they kept to that. There are a lot of wonderful priests up in Ireland that I met. These were called like renegade priests because they were on the outside. They helped with the people. They stayed with the people who were resisting. And the people did not buy this thing that the IRA was communist, or if it was, who cared? It was their communist. From that time on, some other scandals hit. There was one, I don't know if anybody has listened to the song, the scandal of the Magdalene Sisters. The Magdalene Sisters ran an orphanage, and they took on fallen women, single women who were pregnant, sometimes from the parish priest, but whatever it was, these were fallen women, and they treated them like slaves. Some of the babies had died and were buried out in the backyard without a grave. The ladies were treated like slaves, and the nuns treated them as sinners. And later, when it all came out, it was a terrible scandal, and the Irish people were very shocked. And they're still making amends, paying off some of the survivors of the Magdalene Sisters. Second big shock came the pedophile scandal. Ireland didn't realize there was a pedophile scandal. There was one Taoiseach. The Taoiseach was the prime minister. Albert Reynolds, a wonderful man, he stood up for the Irish cause all the time. He made one mistake. He refused to grant extradition of an Irish priest to the north. The Irish priest was accused of pedophilia. And that got out, and the Irish people got mad. Anyway, Albert lost his leadership. It was sad because that was probably the only bad thing he did. But from then on, the scandal unraveled that the Irish Church had hidden pedophilia and protected pedophile priests in numerous occasions. They had something called the Ryan Report. The Ryan Report indicated there were almost 30,000 victims in Ireland. This was at a time that we were discovering it here, and it was being discovered in Germany, all over. And the Vatican, of course, was taken back because they were the ones who were protecting all these the real renegade priests.
Was Ireland any worse than that than the other countries?
No, except that they were one of the countries that prided themselves on being a Catholic country and being very rigid and very loyal to their priest. And all of a sudden, these are little crumblings that I'm giving you that broke that great power that the Catholic Church had over the people, when all of a sudden the people realized that the emperor had no clothes.
Was this about simultaneous with problems with the pedophile priests, or was it sooner?
They came later. We started to have it over here.
We started it first.
Yeah, they were having it. They didn't know it.
They weren't exposed.
They didn't know about it. It was there. But one of the funny things I remember of when I was over there is, this was a shock to the Irish people too. There was a bishop named Casey. And Bishop Casey was well loved. The people really loved him. And all of a sudden it was discovered that Bishop Casey had a wife and a child who was about 21 years of age. I was in a house with a wonderful Irish woman, and she said, "Well," she said, now he'd lived with her for 21 years. He said, "It must have been the woman." That was the typical Irish thought back there. It couldn't have been Bishop Casey. You know, he lived with her for 21 years, had a son, but it must have been the woman. The poor guy, he had to separate. The Vatican made him separate, renounce his marriage, renounce his son, and leave. Anyway, that was one of the scandals. That you just keep chipping away at this fence, and little by little, the pieces fall. They had that, as I said, they had the scandal with a poor woman who died in an Irish hospital on the abortion thing. So, little by little, the Catholic Church's hold over Ireland and the Irish people disappeared. One of the nicest, two of the nicest things I just saw recently, the Irish people took a vote on gay marriage, and it passed overwhelmingly. And our Pope, the Catholic Pope, who is a wonderful man, he seems to be doing a wonderful thing, he's still bound into that contraceptive abortion. He's still bound by that. He came out and condemned the Irish vote as being immoral. I thought that was, you know, that was a chance for him to stand back and say something nice. And about 2 weeks ago, the Irish passed a law that nobody heard about. They allowed transgender people to register simply by registering without any examinations, without any doctors, without any of the stuff. And they became one of the first countries to allow the rights of transgender people. That must have been a shock to the Catholic Church, although I don't know why the Catholic Church has anything against transgender people. I don't know why the Catholic Church has anything against contraceptives, all that stuff, but they do, for some reason. That's a big thing with it.
I don't think they want their wives having fewer babies. The Church is having problems in terms of dying anyhow.
That you know, that was one of the funny things, because under Brehon law, the women were equal. Under Irish law and the Catholic influence, women did not have education. They did not have jobs. They were encouraged to stay home and have babies. And it wasn't until the 30s that the women started to revolt and started getting the vote and a few other things and started sounding off. And now the women are very strong in their opposition to a lot of things. One of the biggest heroes of the Irish struggle was a woman named Countess Markovitch, and she was at the barricade with a rifle, and she was an actual countess, I don't know, a Polish or something like that, and she was right there fighting with the men. And so, like Sinn Féin, when they started politicking, I look over some of their policies, and they're pro women's rights, they're pro gay people, they're pro tolerance. Right down the line, I see all these things that sound wonderful, and the Irish people are accepting this, and they are tolerant, and they're learning how to stand up for what they want. So I see good things in the future. The sad thing was, look about Ireland when they lost all their people, the famine. The famine, by the way, is also an interesting story. There was no shortage of food in Ireland from 1846 on. There was a blight of the potato. And the potato was the only crop that the Irish ate. And there was a reason for that. The English had a system. Good old English every time. The system was, first of all, you could raise food on your land. That's that. But that was a rent you paid for your land. the only food you could keep out of what you raised was the potato. So for most of these poor farmers, when the potato failed, they died in the streets. They died in the ditches. But in the meantime, corn, barley, wheat was being taken away under English soldiers. They made sure the Irish couldn't get their own food. It gets worse. When the Quakers started sending food in, the English insisted no food could come in unless it came to England first. It was unloaded, put on English ships, and then brought over to Ireland. the whole thing of the famine was genocide. Mm-hmm. Irish people trying to get out of Ireland would get on what was known as coffin ships. Mm-hmm. Most of them died on the way over. But they sailed to America, not like the Mexicans today, not because they wanted to leave Ireland. The Mexicans don't want to leave Mexico. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to leave their own country. They left because they were starving to death in their own country. And the Mexicans, we could get into that on another time, were a lot of the cause of their suffering. But they couldn't find jobs, and that's why they came to this country.
Mm-hmm. What the Quakers do about having to take it to Great Britain first?
Yep, they had to take it, unload it, put it on British ships, and then pay the freight, and then sail it over to Ireland.
The British did carry out their part of that bargain. They didn't intercept it.
Oh no, because they made money. They were in the business of making money. And of course that's how they justify the whole famine. It was all laissez-faire. It was allow the market to have its place. And just because there was a famine going on, you didn't interfere with it. You didn't come out with any laws. But I wondered what would have happened if that famine had taken place in England, if people in London were starving to death. I wonder if they take the same idea that you couldn't interfere with the market and that you couldn't do. But anyway, it didn't happen. Listen, I've talked enough, and I want to give you some books. I want to give you some, first of all, I brought a couple of books for you if you want. The British War Machine in Ireland by Father Maurice Burke, and here's a copy of a leaflet. This was a case that I worked on. The Irish asked me when I made my trips over to Ireland, they found out I was a judge, they asked me to come over and sit in on unofficial inquests. We would sit in on cases where the British killed people and refused to have an inquest. So the people had their own inquest. This is one of them, if you're interested in that kind of thing. Some of the books I wanted you to kind of look at, and you might want to write these down. But Thomas Fleming was one. I said he is a great historian. Another man is a woman who writes about the collusion in Ireland and the killings is named Anne Cadwallader. She wrote a book called Lethal Allies, and she's making a tour now of Australia, New Zealand, a lot of countries giving talks. It's well documented on all the collusive. By collusion, I mean where somebody was killed by the loyalists, but they got their guns or their help from the British Army, and that was collusion. So the British would pay these loyalists to go kill the Irish
on paper,
and they wouldn't investigate. Anne Cadwallader wrote a wonderful book. There's another book that's out of date, and you might be able to get it on eBay. It was, the British tried to stop it, but it was called The Committee by Sean McPhillany, and he described some of these activities in the North. And any book written by, Tim Pat Coogan. Any book written by Tim Pat Coogan is a good history of Ireland and its struggles. And of course the one The one is by the Jewish fellow who wrote the book about Ireland. You know, the trouble getting old, your mind goes.
Tell us about it.
He wrote a famous book about Ireland.
Don't push it and it will come.
Yeah, maybe. Anyway, he was Jewish. And and he wrote a nice book about it. But those are the ones I would suggest that you take a look at. And of course, those will give you, if you would want to go further, there's a jump off into other books. But why don't I open it up for questions and see.
Yeah, Andy, I have a question. When Dave and I were living in your house one winter, we got a phone call one time. They asked for you. Now, I have a very dim memory of this, so I really don't know what I'm talking about. But I remember that Dave and I had the feeling that you were in some sort of trouble with somebody for having taken up this law business. Am I right on? Did you?
Well, I had gotten two bits of trouble. They're not real trouble. Mm-hmm. One, I had an FBI guy come by my house, which is kind of funny, because my father was involved in a lot of politics when he was young, and he got a whole file on him, on who he ate lunch with, and of course everything blackened out, and it kind of bothered me that when I was doing all this work, nobody seemed to know I was doing it, and all of a sudden I get this phone call from the FBI guy. Wanted to interview me. And I said, hey, I made it, you know. I'm right up there with my father. And I said, sure, come on over. And he said, I want to talk to you a little bit. He says, I want to know what you, do you know anything about the IRA? And I said, yeah, I know everything about the IRA. And it's, you know, he gets his book out. And I look over, I got a book called Tim Pant Coogan. It's called The IRA. I said, it's all here in this book, but you can't have my book. You know, you got to get your own book. So finally, after I asked some of his questions, I said, why are you here? What did I do? He said, well, the British government wanted to know who you were. I said, the British government? Wow! I said, who is Margaret Thatcher? Or who? Well, it turned out that some warden in Northern Ireland, I used to go visit the prisoners when I was up there, and I'd sign in, and one time I saw a guy, and I didn't know who he was. I was staying with his father, and I had some time, and I told the father, I'll go see your son. So I went to see, and of course, when you're in prison, you can't talk about anything. You know, you talk about the weather and this. Everything is recorded, see. I had no idea who this guy was. So I come back, and about 4 months later, I find out he was the commandant of the IRA in the prison. So here is this FBI guy. The warden saw my name, and I'm seeing this guy. And he wanted to know, who is this guy? Anyway, they went to Fitchburg Police Department. They went there, and they finally, I get a call back, and this FBI says, you've been cleared. I said, I've been cleared, holy. He says, but I don't want you to tell anybody about it. I said, oh, wow. Yeah. I said, you have my confidence. I said, what do you mean, don't tell anybody? But the other thing is, one of the guys they asked for was a guy, Christopher, I can't think of his name. He's in Chicago. He was a real nutcase. And he used to sit around with all these old men. I'm old, but these guys were old. And they were talking about, we're going to get guns, and we're going to, you know, they're doing all this crazy talk. They can't even sit on the chair, you know. They got about five of them. The FBI, they send some guy from Boston, all wired up, and he comes in, and he's sitting with all these old men. Now, these old men were not stupid, and they knew all about conspiracies, as every Irishman does. So they grab this guy, and they pull his shirt up, and they see the microphone, and they take it and they put it down the toilet or something, and the FBI got mad. They wanted it back. So they're asking me, and this guy Chris kept calling me, asking me for advice, and my advice was very easy. I said, you don't have to tell them anything, just shut up and keep your mouth shut. Anyway, the FBI picks up these phone calls between me and Christopher, And he said, why were you talking? I said, that's very strange. I said, I'm a lawyer. I'm very strange that some guy who might be in trouble in Chicago would call me. I think you should put that down in your book, I said. So I laughed it off, you know. I mean, that was the strings. They wanted to prosecute these old guys for destroying their microphone, you know. But the FBI was all over trying to find people who were helping the IRA, people who were trying to send guns to the IRA, any of that. And there were a lot of guns being sent, but hey, hi. So, and I'm sorry I didn't have any money. I would have sent some guns too, but once you get off the plane, somebody said, whose side are you on? Once you get off the plane in Ireland, you become on one side or another. You can't stay in the middle. Yeah. And as I said, I like the Irish songs. They sang better. They had fiddles. They had ballrooms. They had great rebel songs. And they had wonderful dancing. And then I looked at the British side and I said, no, you guys, all you have is bonfires and you run around and beat these Lambert drums. I said, that's not for me.
I enjoyed all your Irish music CDs at the house.
Well, I took sides immediately. But the other thing is, once you get off the plane, they knew who you were. Mm-hmm. They knew everything about you. Mm-hmm. I was driving along the car on way up to some place. I was doing a hearing. And they stopped my car. And they sent an Irish policeman up. And he had the face of Ireland written all over. The soldiers are all back there with guns pointed at my car, but they send this guy up, and he's got a big smile, and he's, oh, are you on vacation? I said, no, not exactly on vacation, just visiting. Oh, you enjoy Ireland? And they knew every reason why I was there. I was there for a hearing. They knew it. And then when I get to the people's house, I went into the house, and I'm sitting there drinking some tea, and I look out, and here are these soldiers outside the window with guns. And I get up and I walk out and I start running after him with my camera. And they all took off. I said, it was a bit of a game, but it was a serious game. I mean, the scary thing was that I would have young kids come up to me with an attack rifle put up against my face and ask me, where were you born? You know, questions like this. And I would have a little fun with them. But I had to realize, first of all, the English have no sense of humor. So I can make fun of them, and they wouldn't know I was making fun of them. And the other thing I had to remember is, that kid has been taught that the Irish are the enemy, and that anybody helping the Irish is the enemy. And he could pull that trigger so fast. But the one good thing in my favor, I was an American, and the English were always afraid of the Americans. They never wanted to hurt the Americans because they needed the Americans. So that was kind of a protection I had.
I have a question in a different direction. And maybe it's not appropriate, but we talked about, or you talked about, the Irish that came over on steerage and crammed like salmon. And very few made it, but they did make it, and not only that, they ran the country here for quite a long time. Yeah. They're only just beginning to lose that hegemony, I guess, probably to Latinos, and who are the next immigrant group, big, huge immigrant group. And I would be very interested sometime in hearing someone talk about how they came from people like my grandpa, who at the age of 10 came and worked on the docks in New York, and ended up in Chicago, where generation after generation had mayors named Kelly, Nellie, and Daley.
When they came, when my grandfather and those people came, there were signs, real signs, Irish need not apply. They were in the New York Times advertising jobs. Nanny wanted, must be sober, Irish need not apply. The Irish, now there was a group called, this is a lecture in itself, Tammany Hall.
Yes.
And everybody makes fun of Tammany because they were corrupt. Well, they were corrupt. They stole a lot of money. But the other thing they did was they stuck up for the Irish. And they were the only protection the Irish had against the WASPs. And the WASPs were slowly losing their power. in New York.
Tammany ran New York,
and pretty soon the cops were Irish, and then all of a sudden the alderman became Irish, and then the mayor, Bill O'Dwyer, right down the line. Pretty soon the Irish, who'd learned nothing out of this, no tolerance, could have put up a sign, nobody else need apply, you know, because they were running the place.
Yeah.
And we had our first, one of the guys I loved, and he went down in flames. He was a smart Irishman. He was stopped because of his religion, and the know-nothings went out against him. They claimed rum Romanism and rebellion. Hal Smith, the happy warrior, ran for president, and he was defeated because he was Irish and because he was Catholic. But that's how far the Irish had come. And of course, a few years later, John Kennedy walks in. And the sad thing about Kennedy, he wasn't Irish. I mean, he had no background. He went to private schools. He spoke with an English accent. He had money. He really wasn't an Irishman, but he had the Irish name.
And but the myth was still there. I can remember when he was up for election, and the scare thing was out about if you vote for him, Rome will own America.
The church will be running the country.
Oh, Tim.
Yeah, some quick footnotes to things that you brought out. You talked at one point about dancing.
Yeah.
There's a form of American folk dancing called clog dancing.
Yes.
It's also done only from the waist down. It is heavily associated with Georgia.
Appalachia.
Appalachia in general, but Georgia in particular. Yeah. And Georgia was originally an English penal colony. Mm. Who do you think they thought the criminals were? So I see that as a tie to Ireland.
But the sad thing, too, was they both brought out as the Irish came over here and went out to the South.
Mm-hmm.
They got into slavery. They got into all this stuff. They were in the Ku Klux Klan. Mm-hmm. You see all those names of some of these politicians, and they were all Irish. They're real sad.
When they weren't Scottish, they were Irish, yes.
Yeah.
Something that many people don't know, I discovered doing a paper in college, the heyday of the Ku Klux Klan was in the 1920s, and it was the Ku Klux Klan, as much as anyone else, who kept Al Smith from getting that Democratic nomination.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, the Klan was primarily anti-Catholic.
Yeah.
And the immediately preceding anti-Catholic movement in America, or anti-Irish, anti-immigrant movement,
the nativism,
was prohibition.
Oh, yeah.
Who drank? The Germans drank. The Irish drank. We don't like them. We're going to interfere with them. And just another...
They had a cartoon. My father ran it. His first campaign, he was elected, and he ran against prohibition. And they had a cartoon, Baby Andy, and he had a whiskey bottle, you know, because that was the indication. That's what the Democrats were for, you know.
Yep.
They wanted prohibition. But, you know, the sad thing, too, is when you look back in the Ku Kluxers and all those kind of things, there's so many Irish faces coming up. There's a book out by Harper Lee that just came out with another one.
Mm-hmm.
You read the first one, To Kill a Mockingbird.
Mm-hmm.
She made Atticus Finch sound like such a great guy, you know. Mm-hmm. Except when you get to the end, I don't know if you noticed that, the end of To Kill a Mockingbird, Atticus Finch's client is taken away by the sheriff.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow he's killed. And everybody knows the deputy killed him. He murdered him.
Yep.
And the sheriff comes up to Atticus Finch and says, don't make a big thing out of it. You know, this is the South. And Atticus Finch didn't. He walks away.
Mm-hmm.
And in that I said to myself, what kind of a great guy was this? His client just got murdered.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a black man and he never said anything. Well, now Harper Lee comes out with the next novel, and we see that Atticus Finch, and she's painting him as a real segregationist and part of the Citizens Council. So it's an interesting how that leap took.
But she didn't want that book to come out, and I'm wondering...
Well, she first tried it. Nobody would publish it.
No. Really?
They wouldn't publish that book, but they took the second one, and that's the one everybody ran with.
But I understand that more recently she... Well, she, I don't know what condition she's in.
She ultimately gave permission.
She had to.
Did she?
Yeah.
Did she or did her lawyer and her...
Well, now they're fighting over the movie rights.
We got another question.
And one last more neutral footnote. Genealogists who are trying to trace roots from America to Ireland run into a certain snag that I learned decades ago, which I thought was interesting. A lack of public records.
Oh, yeah, going it's all back, the parishes.
Well, you find the records in the parishes or among the Quakers, but the public records you can't find prior to a certain date. And the reason was that when the rising of the moon came and the general post office building was burned in Dublin, that's where the vital records were.
That could be.
And they went up in flames.
That could be. That could be. You know.
What year was that?
But there are people now going through the parish records. It's kind of funny. I can't talk to my ancestors, and I wish, because I had so many questions. I had a grandfather whose name was Summers, Arthur Summers. He got married, and I found his marriage certificate, and it shows Arthur Somers was married on such a date. Mm-hmm. One of the witnesses was his brother, Charles Summers. Now they're all dead. Hey guys, how come both of you spelling your names differently? You know, you're both brothers. One is using the English spelling, the other's using the Irish. Well, how come? But
I have that in my family. If you go back to the 1800s, there were siblings, and some spelled the name the English way, because it was originally an English surname, and others modified it to coincide with the Irish pronunciation.
Well, one sort of, if you get to money and money interest, it was easier to get a job if you were English than if you were Irish. So that could be, but who knows? I can't talk to those people. I wish I could. But the reason I got over there, I went over with my kids and we ran around and people found out who I was. And I kept getting these calls and they wanted me to get involved in these hearings. I went 2 years ago to Ireland. I won a trip. And Mary and I went over, and I went to see all the people that I saw are now running the country. Mm-hmm. The last time I saw them, they're all in prison. Mm-hmm. Danny McNamee was, I had to talk through a plastic thing. Mm-hmm. Patricia Anderson, she was in for murder. I had to talk to her with guards all around. Everyone I talked to was in prison, and now they're running the country. I said, you know, are there changes? Yeah, there are changes. The English are still not out. They're still holding on. And they've still got the police. They run the police. But it's a lot better. When I went in the 80s, I'd be driving down the road and I'd see in the bush a face with a rifle pointed out. Mm. Things have changed. So some guy said, you know, they're still here, but you can't see them. And I said, I don't know which is better. I think I'd rather see them. But they're still around, you know. And they still use, England still uses that as a training area. Mm-hmm. They've got soldiers. They've got more soldiers up there. They had about 10,000 at one time. And you got to remember, the north of Ireland is no bigger than Maine. Mm-hmm. So try to think of maybe 10 or 20,000 soldiers in Maine. I mean, they'd be piled up, standing up. But they're all over the place. That's, anyway.
That effect might be why you hear different things, like the case where that lady was basically murdered because they wouldn't do an abortion.
Yeah.
And then on the opposite side, there's the voting for the rights of gays.
Yeah. That abortion, they have not come to a term. They've just changed the laws on it, but they haven't come full swing. By that I mean they still do not recognize incest or rape as a reason for abortion. They now recognize the life of the mother. That was a big step. But when they're making these steps, all I can say is, it's coming. It's coming, because the power of the church has diminished. and they don't have the power they used to have. They can't roar from the pulpit the way they used to. Anyway, thank God. Thank God for changes. Thank God I saw some changes, and which means my kids will see changes, and hopefully they'll be better. But in the meantime, we're going through the same bullshit here in this country. So,
yeah,
we worry about other countries. You better try and fight our own battles, too.
And thank you, Andy, for talking to us about Ireland.
Appreciate it.